Good evening. Welcome to the third Engelsberg lecture. My name is Christopher Coker. I am director of LSE Ideas, which is the foreign policy think tank of the London School of Economics. And this is the third in a series of lectures, which we bring to you thanks to the generosity of the Axel Johnson Foundation in Sweden. Our first lecture series was on populism, our second on empires, past and present, and our third series, the next four lectures, in fact, will be on alliances, especially the alliances, the first half of the 20th century. And we're delighted to have as our Engelsberg lecturer this academic year, Margaret Macmillan. I think she needs no introduction. Her books are international bestsellers. I just mentioned a few, Peacemakers, a book on the Versailles Conference, a very challenging book called The Uses and Abuses of History, and most recently, a very well-received book, War, How History Has Shaped Us. She was a Reith lecturer in 2018, and she is a prize winner. Prizes include the Duff Cooper and Samuel Johnson Awards. She's an honorary fellow of Lady Margaret Hall in Oxford. And her lecture today is entitled Alliances and War from the Delian League to the First World War. Just to establish some ground rules for those who are Twitter users, the hashtag today is LSE Engelsberg. This lecture will be recorded and will be available as a podcast in due course. And there will be, of course, a question and answer session at the end of Margaret's lecture. Will you please post up your questions as soon as they occur to you so that I can actually see them in the Q&A box. But as they say, without further ado, Margaret, over to you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Chris, and thanks to all of you who've given up an evening to sign on for this. I would so much rather be at the LSE talking to people in a room, but we do what we do, and Zoom, thank goodness, has stepped in. And I'm really honored and pleased to be the Engelsberg Chair in History and International Relations this year. And I want to thank the LSE Ideas and the Axel Johnson Foundation for making it possible. I was so pleased both to be invited and when I saw the title of the chair, because I think too often history and the study of international relations go along separate paths. And I think it's very important that they work together and inform each other. I think history can illuminate and help inform choices that policymakers and others have to make in the present. And so much, as we know, of international relations theory is based on historical case studies. And so I think anything that can be done to bring these two disciplines together, I think is very, very important. I chose the subject of alliances because it's partly something I think that is on our minds at the moment, as some of the alliances that survived the Second World War and survived the Cold War seem to be in disarray. And we are dealing, I think, with a world which is increasingly uncertain. And so the question of what do alliances do? Do we need them? Should we have them? Is particularly important at the moment. There are, I think, two main views on the value of alliances. One is alliances are basically a good thing. They can be a deterrent to aggression in peacetime. They can bring together nations to work for a common cause and can help to maintain the peace. In war, a good alliance can also help to pool the resources of different powers and ensure, or at least help to bring about victory. And we can think of examples in the past of alliances that have worked. One of the ones I'm going to talk about today is actually a very improbable one, an alliance between the British and French, hereditary enemies for so many centuries, but that alliance in the First World War was absolutely key to the Allied victory. And sometimes when I look at it, I can't believe that it actually came, they actually came together and the alliance managed to survive. We think of the Grand Alliance in the Second World War. Again, improbable in a way, Britain, United States, and the Soviet Union, but it was absolutely crucial in the victory over the Axis powers. And I think you could argue, and many have argued, that in the Cold War, NATO, the NATO alliance, was extremely important, that it brought together like-minded nations to resist further Soviet encroachments, and that it was critical both in containing the Soviet Union and perhaps in ending the Cold War and in the disappearance of the Soviet Union. I think we're realizing today, as some of those older alliances, NATO, for example, are perhaps not as strong as they once were, that alliances come together for a particular cause, often a particular threat, but that they must be nurtured and maintained. like any other relationships, whether between people or between groups of people, you don't just make a deal once. The deal is ongoing. You have to contain the tensions. You have to deal with the issues that come up. You have to keep building it. There is another school of thought, and these are not, of course, mutually exclusive, and that is that alliances can be very dangerous indeed, that alliances can lead nations into trouble where they might not have necessarily found themselves otherwise. You probably all know the famous farewell address of George Washington, President George Washington, who in 1796 warned the American people that they should be very careful about getting involved in alliances. Commercial relations, he said, were fine, but political relationships should be avoided. The United States, he said, and this was actually not an address he gave, it was a newspaper article he wrote, the United States had particular advantages bestowed on it partly by geography, and he asked, why forego the advantages of so peculiar a situation? Why quit our own to stand upon foreign ground? Why, by interweaving our destiny with that of any part of Europe, entangle our peace and prosperity in the toils of European ambition, rivalship, interest, humor, or caprice? It is our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world. And I think he meant above all Europe, which, like many Americans then and perhaps even today, he saw as a source of entangling alliances, the old style diplomacy, Machiavellian plotters, and so on. But it wasn't just George Washington who felt like this. Much closer to home, of course, Lord Palmerston, who was Secretary of State at the time, said in a famous speech in 1847 in the House of Commons, a speech, incidentally, he was making in reply to accusations that he was a Russian agent, and there was an attempt, in fact, made to impeach him for treason. And he, in the course of a long speech, he said, "I hold with respect to alliances that England is a power sufficiently strong, sufficiently powerful to steer her own course and not to tie herself as an unnecessary appendage to the policy of any government. England," he went on to say, "must remain true to its principles and interests, and where necessary, can find support from other states, but only as a temporary arrangement." And then in words that became quite famous, he said, "Therefore I say that it is a narrow policy to suppose that this country or that is to be marked out as the eternal ally or the perpetual enemy of England. We have no eternal allies and we have no perpetual enemies. Our interests are eternal and perpetual, and those interests it is our duty to follow." In the aftermath of the First World War, as people searched, as they're still searching today, for the causes of that war, the alliance systems, as they were called, were often blamed for creating the war. The fact that Europe had divided itself up into two different systems of alliances, on the one hand, the Triple Alliance of Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Italy, on the other hand, the Triple Entente of Russia, France, and Britain, led to the war becoming a general one. The argument made against the alliances is that they created a chain of relationships that when one partner got into a conflict with someone from the other alliance, it almost inevitably drew in those alliance partners. I will actually say where I don't think this was the case, but it certainly became a standard view, and it still is, you'll often hear it today, that it was really the alliances that made the First World War a general war and so disastrous. And this question of how much an alliance system can lead other nations into war, of course, is one that is still with us today. It seems to me a very live question. What will happen if a member of NATO, say Poland or the Baltics, runs into trouble with its neighbors? And we know that this is a possibility. What might happen if Taiwan is suddenly attacked by China? The United States has no formal defense treaty with Taiwan, unlike the NATO treaty, but it gives it considerable military aid. And just last month, President Biden, when he was asked in a CNN town hall about what the United States would do if China were to attack Taiwan, said, "I don't want a Cold War with China. I just want to make China understand that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views." And when he was asked directly, would the United States be prepared to come to the defense of Taiwan, he said yes. And so you can understand why people see alliances both in positive and negative terms. So what I want to do in this lecture and in the ones that will follow is look at alliances, particularly with relevance to war, ask that question, do they prevent wars or help to create them? Ask why alliances come into existence, and then ask what makes them effective or not in war and in the peace that follows on wars. Those who have been part of alliances often have a rather low opinion of them. In the First World War, the French general who commanded Allied forces at Salonika said to Clemenceau, the French prime minister, "Since I have seen alliances at work, I have lost something of my admiration for Napoleon." And what he meant was that Napoleon always fought coalitions and always won. General Eisenhower, who was masterly in trying to keep the Allies together as the supreme Allied commander, wrote in 1948 of the ineptitude of coalitions in waging war. And he had seen it, of course, firsthand. And he went on to say something very much like that French general. "Even Napoleon's reputation as a military leader suffered when students in staff colleges came to realize that he always fought against coalitions and therefore against divided councils and diverse political, economic, and military interests." And perhaps we should leave the final word on the problems of alliances to Winston Churchill, who said in April 1945, "There is only one thing worse than fighting with allies, and that is fighting without them." And so alliances are not easy, as we know, even in our own experiences. Now, there are two different definitions at work in alliances, and I'm going to use the broader one. There is a narrower one. And the narrow definition of an alliance, which is often favored by political scientists, is that it is based on a treaty. An alliance is something that has a formal treaty that binds two or more independent states to come to each other's aid with armed forces under certain circumstances. So in that narrow definition, an alliance is something that promises the use of force in particular circumstances. In other words, almost inevitably will be triggered by an act of war. That alliance will combine the power of states against a common enemy or threat. NATO's Article 5, I think, is an expression of that kind of alliance, where it says an attack on one is an attack on all. But I think I prefer a slightly broader definition, because we know that alliances can contain many different elements and that they're not dependent just on a formal written document. What alliances tend to depend on is cooperation, a history of working together, the development of trust, and development of an understanding of each other. And so I would use a broader definition. There may be a military alliance in an alliance, a military treaty in an alliance, but an alliance is often more like an agreement that we will work together for the time being because we share common goals, at least certain common goals. And so in the sorts of alliances I want to look at, I want to take into account that broader definition, the alliance which doesn't necessarily have to be written down, but involves certain understandings which often evolve over time. And I think if you look at the broader definition of alliances, you could also argue, and I will argue, that they're not just about defense. They're not just about military action, that they can in fact involve other things. They can involve, for example, working together for common goals. And so after the Napoleonic Wars, the Concert of Europe, which had been so successful as the Grand Alliance in defeating Napoleon, remained together to try and create a more stable Europe, which would not suffer a repetition of the Napoleonic Wars. And even the NATO treaty, which did set up a military alliance, has as its Article 2, this is something that Canadians know because we insisted on putting it in, Article 2 was to develop peaceful and friendly international relations. And so I think alliances in the broader sense can have longer term goals, broader goals than simply military ones. And I think there's another element of alliances which we need to take into account, and that sometimes is an alliance can be about managing your own alliance partners, that you sometimes join an alliance because you think it's better to be on the inside dealing with a country that is potentially disruptive or might get itself into trouble or might get you into trouble, better to be somehow connected to them. When Bismarck made the dual alliance of 1879 with Austria-Hungary, it was partly to prevent war between Austria-Hungary and Russia. He was worried that Austria-Hungary was confronting Russia in the Balkans and along their common borders, and what the last thing he wanted was a war between those two great powers. And so an alliance can also act as a way of constraining alliance partners. I think you can argue that at the time of Suez, the United States, which was in an alliance with Britain, used its power to prevent the British from doing what they were doing in Suez, and actually used their considerable power to keep the British from making more enemies in the Middle East. Well, there are a number of reasons why alliances come into existence, and generally shared interests can matter, but generally there is an element of threat. We can see alliances perhaps developing out of pandemics, although the recent pandemic has not perhaps been that successful. We have to hope that one day there will be the development of more sustained and serious and effective alliances against climate change. The threat, I think, is probably an almost essential part of having an alliance. But war, of course, remains perhaps the greatest glue for an alliance. And we see time and again that countries will come together in a war because they feel they have no choice. But when it begins to appear that the war is ending, when the prospect of peace and victory seem to come, then you will often find the alliance beginning to splinter as different interests which have been submerged in the common endeavor will now come to the surface again. We saw it at the end of the First World War as national interests reasserted themselves, and we saw it again, of course, at the end of the Second World War. And we saw it, since I did mention that this lecture would start with the Delian League, I thought I'd better mention it. So if you look at slide one, which I'll ask if we could put up, these are coins that were struck in Athens at the time of the great coalition against the Persians. And the coins were important because they helped Athens both to accumulate and to store resources, to raise revenues. And these revenues were going to be used by Athens, and Athens was also going to raise revenues from its partners in the Confederation against the Persians, was going to use them to create the forces, particularly the triremes, the warships, that were going to be key in the battles against the Persians and in expelling the Persians from Europe. And so the Delian League, which was formed in 478 after considerable struggle against the Persians already, was going to be one of those examples of an alliance which comes together in the face of a common threat, in which the members of the alliance pool their resources. Very much like other alliances, as the enemy was defeated, the alliance began to fall to pieces, and the tensions which had always been there between Athens and a number of the other Greek partners, in particular Sparta, of course, were going to explode into the Peloponnesian War in 431. So that alliances will come together, and as they seem to have done throughout history, but they will not always survive the achievement of whatever it is they came together for. Sometimes alliances are purely opportunistic. People make them simply because it seems like the thing to do at the time or because they feel they have little choice. So if we could see slide two, that was this second kind of rather more opportunist alliance. This is Napoleon's alliance, a meeting with Alexander I, the Tsar of Russia, and Friedrich Wilhelm I of Prussia at Tilsit in 1807. And they met, as you probably know, on a raft in the middle of a river, so they would not meet on anyone's territory. And Alexander I, who was an intensely emotional and impressionable young man, was, like a lot of young men in Europe at the time, enormously admiring of Napoleon, even though Napoleon had caused all sorts of trouble for Russia, and was prepared to work with him, at least for the time being. Frederick Wilhelm was simply trying to keep his throne and keep further depredations of the French, keep from losing even more territory. But this was very much an alliance that was imposed on both Alexander I and Friedrich Wilhelm. And Napoleon had no intention of treating them as equals. And in the long run, in fact, in the short run, the alliance wasn't going to last for very long at all. By 1812, Prussia was already leaving and Russia had been invaded by Napoleon. So this was an alliance that was made very much under pressure and was not, in fact, going to last very long. The three partners in the alliance did not really have sufficient interests in common, did not have sufficient values in common. And the two members, Russia and Prussia, were not prepared to accept Napoleon's control for any length of time. Bismarck always said, rather cynically, the great German chancellor, Bismarck always said rather cynically that every alliance must have one horse and one rider. And he certainly made sure that was the case when he formed the alliance with Austria. It was quite clear that Germany was to be the rider and Austria was to be the horse. But in the case of that alliance, both countries had enough long-term interests that they were prepared to maintain it up to and during the First World War. Now, there are a number of features that, of course, are different about every alliance, different times, different values, different histories. But I think we can also find commonalities if we look at alliances throughout history. One thing I think we always have to remember about alliances is they are dynamic. You don't just sign an agreement and that's that. It's not like buying a house. You don't sign the deal, you don't get the house. An alliance is much more like a relationship that keeps on evolving and developing, and it will change with shifts in domestic situations, changes perhaps in government. It will change with shifts in power. In the Second World War, we can see very clearly that Britain and the British Empire began to take second place behind the United States. The growing power of the United States, once it entered the war, meant that Britain was no longer the dominant partner in fighting the Axis powers. Some very, very significant shift took place in the Second World War as British power simply became, it was still considerable, but it simply could not match up to American power. And alliances also change depending on shifts in external circumstances. One of the things that alliance partners often worry about is that the enemy will try and do a deal with one of them and therefore break up the alliances, and then this can sometimes happen. What I think is also, as I said earlier, very important in alliances is the maintenance. And diplomacy, I think, is a key part of it. An alliance is, again, not just a document. An alliance is a process, it's a relationship, it's an understanding. It has to be built and trust has to be maintained. I think we can see examples of where countries develop mistrust for each other and are no longer prepared to work with each other. Memory, I think, can be very important in either fostering or undermining an alliance. Napoleon managed to survive 5 out of 6 coalitions against him because so many of those opposing him did not trust each other. They feared that what was going to happen, that Napoleon would pick them off one by one, and often indeed, this is what Napoleon did. In the Second World War, Stalin frequently, the leader of the Soviet Union, frequently expressed his fears that his partners, the United States and Britain, would make a separate peace with Germany. In fact, the only person who did apparently even contemplate making a separate peace was in fact Stalin himself. But these sorts of suspicions are often there in alliances. Transition, moving, as alliances move from peace, they're formed in peace often with the prospect of war in the offing, but as they move from peace into war, then indeed you get further problems. War brings fresh problems, fresh tensions. It, of course, sharpens the perception of the enemy, but it also brings differences of opinion on how to fight that enemy, on the war aims, and then, of course, the aims for the peace. How do you develop a strategy among a number of different people with different interests and different ways of doing things? How do you develop a strategy to try and win a war? I mean, one of the problems that the Allies had in the Sixth Coalition, the one that finally defeated Napoleon, was that there were profound disagreements among the different generals and the different military about the best ways to fight Napoleon. And this can be very difficult indeed. Indeed, sometimes there can be what seem like absurd technical difficulties that make translating strategy into operational efficiency difficult. I came across an example of this the other day, which I found extraordinary, but of course makes sense. One of the tactics in the First World War that the British and the French eventually developed, and it was a painful process, but they eventually developed a tactic of supporting an attack with an artillery barrage. They would plaster the enemy lines, hoping that this would destroy the enemy defenses, but they would move the barrage ahead. It was called a creeping barrage. And so the British and French soldiers coming out of their trenches would move behind this great artillery barrage, which was itself advancing towards the German lines. But there was a technical problem which caused all sorts of difficulties, and that was that the French measured, they wanted to advance so many meters per minute, the British barrage was advancing so many yards per minute. And every so often, the French would actually have to stop and wait for the British to catch up. And so even at that level of tactical level, just the difficulties of bringing together different ways of fighting, different ways of training, I think can be seen. One of the problems that often bedevils alliances in wartime as well is who's going to command. And this, of course, you run into individual jealousies, individual demands, but you also run into national jealousies and demands. One of the difficulties in the First World War between the British and the French was, should it be the French, a French general who commanded? This was certainly something the French themselves thought was appropriate because they felt they were doing the bulk of the fighting, certainly in the early years. And the British, of course, felt that they should have a British general because they were doing the bulk of supporting the war effort. In the Napoleonic Wars, when the final six coalition came together in 1813, the one that was going to defeat Napoleon, there was a real problem that the Allies had with Alexander I, who wanted to command and did not have the abilities to be a good commander. Napoleon himself said of Alexander, he had great abilities, but something was always missing in whatever he did. And since one could never quite foresee which particular piece would be missing in any given instance, he was totally unpredictable. Finally, partly through Metternich's, and I'll talk about Metternich in a moment, the Austrian chancellor, partly through Metternich's diplomacy, the Austrian Prince Schwarzenberg, a general himself, experienced general and also a very experienced diplomat, was chosen as the Allied commander. And he later complained that his position was almost intolerable. He said, "It is really inhuman what I must tolerate, surrounded as I am by feeble-minded people, fools of every description, eccentric project makers, intriguers, asses, babblers, and so on." He said, "I often think I'm going to collapse under their weight." And there can be a further problem in wars, not just in agreeing on a unified command, but in getting the civilians and the military to work together. Too often in wars, the military will argue that the civilians don't know what they're talking about, that the military should make the final decisions, and that can cause problems. And we need only think of the Korean War, where General MacArthur defied civilian orders from the President of the United States, and eventually there was a showdown, and MacArthur, in fact, was removed. But it was a very, very difficult moment. What I think can also be important in alliances are individual relationships. Marlborough, in the Wars of the Spanish Succession, kept the coalition together and also worked very well with Prince Eugene of Savoy. Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan worked very well together in dealing with the Soviet Union, and I think that was partly because they had established a very good personal relationship. I'd like to now show you Metternich, who I mentioned earlier in slide three, who I think was key. Prince Metternich, often seen as a reactionary, which I think is an unfair assessment, was in fact one of the great statesmen, in my view, of the early 19th century, and was responsible, I think, more than almost anyone else for bringing together the sixth coalition against Napoleon. It was brought together by his diplomacy. There are others who contributed to it, Lord Castlereagh, the British Foreign Secretary, and I'll talk about him in a moment, and also Napoleon himself, who made it quite clear that he was not going to surrender, that he was not going to give up his goals of dominating France. But I think perhaps fair to say that without Metternich, these different countries with their difficult and often complicated leaders, with their national jealousies, their national rivalries, their national sense of importance, with their national interests, might not have been brought together and kept together without the tireless diplomacy of Metternich, who crisscrossed Europe, not in easy circumstances, but traveling by coach, often exhausted, often sleeping in very uncomfortable places, but who managed to persuade Britain, Prussia, Russia, and his own country of Austria to work together to defeat Napoleon. He worked closely with Lord Castlereagh, who I'll show you now in slide four, the British Foreign Secretary. When the two men met, they felt as if they understood each other. Metternich said in a letter, he said, "I have only just met him and I feel that we talk very much in the same way." And he, along with Metternich, was key in creating what came to be the Quadruple Alliance. The Austrians contributed forces, so did the others, of course, and the British contributed in increasingly important amounts of aid. Hundreds of cannon, hundreds of guns, millions of rounds of ammunition, uniforms, £11 million of subsidies, and who knows what difference it made, 28,000 gallons of brandy and rum to the Quadruple Alliance. What also, of course, counted against Napoleon was that he was being defeated militarily. The invasion of Russia in 1812 had been a disaster, and as we can see from slide five, he was also dealing with one of the most effective generals opposing him, the Duke of Wellington, who managed, by the time the Quadruple Alliance came together, had managed to clear the French out of Spain and was moving into France from the south. As I said earlier, Napoleon himself also helped to keep the Quadruple Alliance in existence. In June 1813, Napoleon met Metternich in Dresden, and Metternich had come to him with an offer. Essentially, the offer was that he could remain the ruler of France, and France would remain within the borders it had at the beginning of the 1790s, but he would have to give up the territory it had taken east of the Rhine. It would have to give up territory to take it in Italy, and it would have to restore Holland. And this Napoleon refused to do. Extraordinary conversation. It must have been extraordinary. The two men talking for 8 hours, and Napoleon made it absolutely clear that he would not give up any of his gains, and that, in fact, if he had a chance, he would resume war again in an attempt to recover what he had already lost. As he left that meeting, Metternich turned to Napoleon and said, "Sire, you are lost." But the importance of that meeting and Metternich's report on it was that it showed the allies in the Quadruple Alliance that there was absolutely no way, short of war, that they would have to, that they would be able to get rid of Napoleon. In March 1814, they bound themselves together in the Treaty of Chaumont, Russia, Prussia, Austria, and Britain, promising no separate peace. They promised no end to fighting until the object of the war, mutually understood and agreed upon, shall have been obtained. And importantly, they also said that they would concert together after peace to make, after the war ended, to make peace with France on the best way to continue peace in Europe. And so the Grand Alliance was, I think, key in defeating Napoleon. He couldn't have been defeated in any other way. He was a master at picking off his individual enemies. And I think without the work of Metternich, of Castlereagh, and without, I think, the attitude of Napoleon himself, it would not have persisted. The Grand Alliance persisted as the concert of Europe into peacetime with a certain amount of efficacy. It, I think, provided a period of peace for Europe, but it was beginning to break down by the middle of the 19th century. And by the end of the century, two large groupings had emerged, the Triple Entente and the Triple Alliance. The Triple Entente started when Russia and France came together. If we can see slide 6, please. They came together in an entente, which developed and grew deeper as the years went by, as this cartoon indicates. It was important for both sides because what Russia had, they both countries had a common border with Germany, because in those days there was no Poland between Russia and Germany. What the Russians had was manpower, and what the French had was money and technology. And they used each other. The French relied on Russian manpower to counter German forces, and the Russians relied on French investments to build their railways and build up their infrastructure. So the Entente, the Triple Entente, started with the French-Russian friendship, and then gradually Britain was drawn into it. And this was one of the most improbable diplomatic revolutions of the period before the First World War, because Britain had been at odds with both France and Russia. And the British feared Russian moves into Central Asia and down towards India, and of course feared Russian moves out towards the Straits. The Russian's long-term goal was to get control of the Straits leading out of the Black Sea into the Mediterranean. And the British and the French had been at odds, of course, for centuries. They had fought around the world in the Seven Years' War. They had fought on each other's soil. They had very nearly come to war in 1898 over Fashoda, a small village where both claimed territory. And so it was, I think, a diplomatic revolution. And what helped to bring it about was that the British were becoming increasingly concerned about the development of a navy by Germany and the threat of a German navy to the British navy. British naval power was absolutely essential from British point of view to maintain its empire and to maintain its dominance of world trade. And so after very difficult negotiations, the French and the British came to an understanding. There was never an alliance, but the Entente Cordiale, if I could see slide 7, please, where the British and the French came together, as this cartoon shows, to sort out some of their outstanding colonial issues and to work together in no formal way at all, but to work together with each other to counter the German threat. And the British then, 3 years later, under a certain amount of urging from the French, made a similar entente with Russia. If I could see slide 8. This is an agreement. One of the areas they were both eyeing with greed was Persia, and it was threatening to worsen relations between them. And here you can see the Russian bear and the English lion with a very small and rather angry looking Persian cat, which has just been, in fact, divided between the two of them in the agreement, the British taking the southern part of Persia and the Russians taking the northern part. Not direct colonies, but areas of influence, which left very little freedom to the Persians themselves. And so you get the formation by 1914 of this triple entente, triple understanding, but there was only one firm alliance in it, and that was the one between Russia and Britain. You had a similar set of relationships on the other side in the triple alliance, Germany and Austria-Hungary first, and then later Italy was added in. And further, later still, when the First World War started, the Ottoman Empire. In fact, as slide 9 will show, that alliance was very much more one that was dominated by Germany. And this is a wartime cartoon, but it gives you an idea of the key German figure dragging along the rather wounded Turkey and the rather wounded Austria. And it really reflects the reality of that alliance as it developed in the world. So did those alliances, which were not really the alliances in the narrow sense, but the broader sense, did those alliances lead to the war? I would say not, but they probably made it more likely. The only alliances, the only firm military alliances were defensive ones. And so no power which had signed such an alliance, Italy, for example, needed to go to war if its alliance partner had started the war. And that, in fact, was the reason that Italy used not to go into the First World War. It argued that Austria had not been attacked. It had, in fact, attacked Serbia. It had, in fact, provoked Russia. And therefore, Italy decided to stay out. And so there was no obligation, really, to go into a war on most of the alliance partners. But I think what the alliances and the talks that they held and the strategies that they discussed helped to make the prospect of war more likely and perhaps helped to build up expectations. I mean, the British were always very cautious not to get involved in any firm commitments to fight a war on the continent of Europe, but they did hold staff talks with the French military. And they said such things as, if we were to get involved in a war, where might we bring our troops to France? So there was no firm commitment, but the French understandably began to feel that the British were intending to come and support them. The British also held naval talks with the French, which resulted, in fact, in an agreement that the French would patrol the Mediterranean and the British in return would look after the French Atlantic ports. And so although the British made no formal commitment, as they pointed out in 1914 to France, they did make a sort of moral commitment, and that is certainly what Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary, thought. Before the war, the alliances could well have changed. It was becoming quite clear that Italy was more and more reluctant to fight on the side, particularly of Austria, which it regarded with some reason as its hereditary enemy. And it was also becoming clear that British and Russian relations were worsening again. And so it is quite possible, if the crisis of 1914 hadn't happened with the assassination of the Archduke at Sarajevo, those two alliance systems might have looked very different by 1915. There was always a possibility that Russia and Austria-Hungary would mend fences, always a possibility that the British and the Russians would not renew their entente of 1907. In fact, the Foreign Office was deeply concerned about it. What is extraordinary, I think, in the preparations for the First World War, even those countries which had tight defensive alliances did not always spell out what they were going to do. The French and the Russians did, in fact, hold staff talks and had a fairly good idea of what they do. And by 1913, the Russians had promised to come to France's aid if the Germans attacked France, as looked increasingly likely, with an attack on Germany within 2 weeks after the attack on France. And so France and Russia did have some idea of what the other was up to and what the other was planning. The ones that I find absolutely extraordinary, who seem not to have communicated at all or hardly at all, were the Germans and the Austrians, who you would have thought, given the long-standing alliance they had, would have consulted frequently. On the 1st of August, 1914, as the First World War was breaking out, the German military attaché in Vienna said to the deputy chief of staff, the German deputy chief of staff, it is high time that the two general staffs consult now with absolute frankness with respect to mobilization, jump-off times, areas of assembly, and precise troop strength. The fact that he was saying this on August the 1st, when there had been decades when the Austrians and Germans could have talked to each other, could have shared ideas about what they were up to, says something about that relationship. It was marked, as became quite clear once the war started, by misassumptions and, I think, often false assurances on both sides. Germany's focus, although they didn't tell Austria this, was always going to be mostly on France. and the greater part of the German army by far was going to be directed into France. What Germany needed was Austria-Hungary to hold off the Russians and in fact to take the offensive in the east. Austria-Hungary was prepared to hold off the Russians, but if it took an offensive in the east, it thought it would do so with German support. And in fact, the Germans had no possibility of offering that support until after they'd defeated France. What the Austrians also omitted to tell the Germans was that although they were prepared to move troops up to the Russian border and possibly even take the offensive against Russia, they intended to finish off Serbia first. And so relations between two powers you might have thought would have worked more closely together, in fact, were marked by lack of information and simply not telling each other what was going to happen. When the war started, a number of issues then became clear. One of the issues, which is interesting in the light of the relationship that later developed, was what would Britain do? The British had assumed that if they entered the war at all, and they did not make that decision until August the 4th, they would use their navy, as they always had done for blockade and for getting support to their continental allies, but they would not fight themselves on the continent of Europe. They would not send an expeditionary force. The decision made to send the British expeditionary force to France was made 2 days after Britain was formally at war, made on August the 6th, and the British government did not decide where to send that expeditionary force until August the 12th. And so the British, I think, of all the powers, had really the loosest ideas of what they might actually do, and what they found themselves doing was not, in fact, what they had intended to do at all. They had no intention in 1914 or in the years before of developing enormous armies and sending them to the continent. That was simply something that happened under the pressure of the war. Of course, war always changes the calculations that those involved in it are making. And the war of 1914-1918 was a war that was particularly shocking to Europeans and to their military. Very few people had expected the sort of war that developed very rapidly in 1914. The first movements in that war turned into trenches, stalemate. It became more and more difficult to attack. Defending the power of the defense had, thanks to technology, was much stronger than the attack. I think very few people, apart from a few civilians and a few pessimists like Lord Kitchener, who became Secretary of State for War, who said the war would last for 3 years. Otherwise, very few people had expected a war that would turn into something that lasted for 4 years. Also, very few people had expected a war that would make such enormous demands on societies, not just for men to fight, but also on the economies, the political structures, the whole resources of societies. And what became very clear during the war was that there needed to be coordination among allies who were fighting, sometimes on different fronts, but sometimes, as in the case of the British and the French, on the same front. There had to be more coordination. It also became clear that there had to be far more attention paid to logistical and economic cooperation. And under the pressure of the war, the relationships on both sides were going to develop, some better than others. Again, the expectation that the dual alliance might have worked, I think, was clearly not the case. The pre-war discussions between the two had shown the gulf between them. What really happened to the dual alliance is that Germany came increasingly to dominate it, as this cartoon shows. By 1916, the Austro-Hungarian army was under German command. General von Hindenburg had become commander of all the Central Powers on the Eastern Front. Austria-Hungary, which increasingly wanted to get out of the war, which recognized that the war, its leaders recognized that the war was probably going to doom Austria-Hungary, found itself helpless to do so. The Triple Entente started off badly, and the key relationship, the one between France and Britain, the one that was going to survive until the end of the war, was not good in the early stages of the war. There was an early crisis when General Sir John French, the commander of the British Expeditionary Force, wanted to head for the Channel ports in August 1914 because he feared that the British were going to be cut off by a German attack. And Kitchener actually had to fly or come over by boat from London in order to insist that he stay there and support the French left wing. The British and the French had a long history, of course, of not trusting each other. And Kitchener himself, Secretary of State for War, had spent much of his career fighting on the frontiers, fending off threats from France or from Russia to the British Empire. And the two continued to have competing interests in the Middle East. Indeed, as the war went on and it looked like the Ottoman Empire might disintegrate, the British and the French found more to quarrel about than before. And I'll talk about that in my next lecture. But again, the early relations were not favorable and did not indicate that the two were going to be getting on terribly well. The French resented the assumption that they felt the British was making, that the British would fight to the last Frenchman. As the head of the French military mission attached to the British Army said, England wants to win with a minimum sacrifice in men. The French looked down on the British commanders. They thought they didn't have British strategic brilliance and elan. Again, the French liaison officer said, the Englishman drifts from day to day without looking beyond the needs of the moment. The British returned the low views. General French himself said of the French, his French counterparts, au fond, he said, and that was about the only French he spoke, actually, au fond, they are a low lot, and one always has to remember the class these French generals mostly come from. General Haig, who did take the trouble to learn French, confided to his diary, the French are so unreliable. One cannot believe a word they say as a rule. The French leaders, he said, were a queer mixture of fallibility and ignorance of the practical side of war. And he said, rather haughtily, the British were too much of gentlemen for them. There was concern always on the part of the British that the French would drop out of the war, afraid that the French were, or at least some French politicians, were defeatist. And there was constant jockeying, and I'll talk about my next lecture, over resources. It was felt by the French the British weren't providing enough manpower, not providing enough resources for the French. It was felt by the British the French were wasting resources, that they weren't managing their own economy well. The relationship, amazingly, between the British and French survived. It was a painful one. It took a great deal of effort on both sides. Fortunately, it survived into 1917, which is going to be the year when real change took place. 1917 brought the American entry into the war, which was going to change the strategic balance in Europe. It also, of course, brought the revolution in Russia and the dropping out of Russia of the war. So I'll look at that next time, the ways in which the alliances worked at the end of the war and the attitudes and policies with which they went into peace. Any war will bring changes in alliances, will bring a rapid evolution of those alliances. The ones that somehow succeed, it often seems improbable. I think looking at alliances at the moment perhaps is a good time, not because we have particularly strong alliances, but because some old alliances are under threats. And we are perhaps realizing, as Russia and Belarus probe around their borders, as the Chinese become increasingly confrontational, we're realizing that cohesion in the face of threats matters, and how alliances are created and maintained is something perhaps that we want to spend more time thinking about. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Margaret. You've raised some excellent points there, and I do want to pick you up on China at the very end, but I would like to concentrate most of the questions on history. And can I start by asking you two questions, starting with the Delian League, which I think is fascinating because if you look at the speech that Thucydides gives Pericles in his funeral oration, where he's talking about our alliances, we give more than we take. Yeah. We have soft power. He doesn't use this term, but we are an inspiration to the rest of the Greek world in terms of our arts and crafts. We keep the Aegean safe for free trade because we get rid of piracy and we spend the money that you give us on a fleet that gets rid of the pirates. And all of this sounds absolute, and you could say, I suppose, it's a league of democracies. I believe that all but three members of the Delian League were actually democracies. So it has certain resonance. You might think of the American alliance system in the 20th century, democracies, making the world safe for free trade, ideational, you mentioned ideas as being absolutely essential, a glue to successful alliances. But on the other hand, many members of the Delian League saw it as an empire rather than an alliance because they felt they didn't have a choice. Mm. And when one's thinking about the American alliance system, one remembers that famous phrase in the 1950s, I forget the name of the Norwegian scholar, empire by invitation. Yeah. This was what made the American alliance system different from, say, the Soviet alliance system. But it was still a kind of imperial system in which you had to know your place, as the British and French discovered at Suez in 1956. If you overstepped the line, you were punished for that. So I just wonder whether you could say something, develop a little bit more the ideational side of alliances and how important you actually think that that is in solidifying these contacts between countries that are members of alliance systems.
Well, I'm interested, you know, I mean, Thucydides' Pericles speech, in a way, although it was much more eloquent, is what Donald Trump was saying when he went to NATO meetings. We're spending all this money and what are we getting out of it? You know, and we're fighting the fight and you are just sort of free riders. And that's always a problem in alliances. But I think when there is some overlap of values and some shared values, they're more likely to last. I mean, you look at the Warsaw Pact essentially ended as soon as the Cold War was over and the Soviet Union fell to pieces because it was imposed. There was absolutely no choice. And I think with the Greek city-state alliance, I mean, I think there was resentment all along of Athens, which was growing more powerful, which was becoming richer, and which did behave often in a very high-handed way. But I still think what perhaps helped to keep them together was this perception that the Persian threat was something that they wanted to resist. I think the Grand Alliance in the Second World War didn't survive the end of the war because the difference between the Soviet Union on the one hand and the Western powers was so great. But the alliance between the Western powers did survive because they did have shared values. And although there is usually, as Bismarck said, a horse and a rider in an alliance, although there is usually one strong partner, if the strong partner shares values with its alliance partners, it will, I think, be more likely to respect their independence and to respect their values. And the United States, although occasionally, but not that often, I think, exerted its power, it did with Suez. And I think it did with Suez because it felt that the British were really threatening the Western alliance and also threatening the position of the West in the among the emerging nations, those nations emerging out of imperialism. And so I think the Americans felt that, in fact, the British action was threatening the alliance as a whole, not particularly American interests, actually. I mean, this was not something that was of particular interest to the Americans. But on the whole, I think the Americans tolerated a fairly free, gave a certain amount of latitude to their alliance partners. I mean, the French could be provocative and were provocative. I mean, General de Gaulle, when he ordered NATO troops out of France, nevertheless, France remained a partner, never abjured the treaty. And the Americans were prepared to put up with this. And I think the phrase empire by invitation, I think was quite a good one. I mean, these were voluntary. Canada joined the Western Alliance, not because it was afraid of American power, because it actually shared many of the goals of the United States. There were disagreements, I think, in the Western Alliance, far more than in the war. Well, the Warsaw Pact, you couldn't have disagreements. So I think ideas do matter. A shared language can matter. I mean, it really did seem to me one of the problems the British had and the French had in the First World War was that they literally didn't speak each other's language. And then gradually people realized we better have some interpreters there because we're making a mess of it. As I say, Haig actually studied French and was able to conduct himself in meetings, but most British generals couldn't speak a word of French. And if French generals had learned another language, they'd learned German because they studied war. So I think an alliance has to bring interest together. You don't go into an alliance unless you see a shared enemy or you see some sort of interest. But I think an alliance is more likely to survive if you share some values in common and if you have ways of dealing with it. Within NATO, in that diplomatic phrase, there were frank and full discussions. I think there were far fewer in the Warsaw Pact.
And of course, if you're thinking of another Anglo-French alliance or Franco-British alliance during the Crimean War, it didn't help that Lord Raglan always referred to the Russians as the French. By mistake, of course, whenever he was ordering a cavalry charge or something of the kind. But you mentioned Trump, and this brings us to the word transactional. What is the difference between, do you not think that the British mostly thought of alliances as transactional until the 20th century, until they actually needed the United States. And for the first time, they had to speak the language of values. Wasn't that always the complaint that their allies had? The War of the Spanish Succession, et cetera, perfidious Albion, that these people were here today and gone tomorrow. Yeah. And for them, it was useful to have this alliance now, but they didn't want to be committed. They didn't want to be committed to the Congress system after the end of the Napoleonic Wars. It was certainly after Castlereagh had gone. Again, Canning was a very transactional foreign secretary. Yeah. Castlereagh, of course, was not.
Yeah. I think, I mean, there's always an element of transaction in an alliance, and the British have a very long tradition of not wanting continental commitments, of not wanting to send their troops over there if they can possibly avoid it. Of course, they have done on many occasions, but if they can use the Navy and if they can use money to achieve their ends. But I do think in the Napoleonic Wars, there was an important alliance based, it was based partly on the perceived threat of Napoleon, which is a very real threat, and the struggle for dominance of Europe and indeed other parts of the world. But I do think there was also a values element to it. I mean, I think the British government had come to dislike very much what Napoleon stood for, as indeed did Metternich. And the fact that the British, at least until Castlereagh's death, and sometimes after that, were prepared to involve themselves in dealing with the European powers seems to me to indicate that they did have some stake and had some perception that a stable Europe would be better for everyone, including them. So I mean, how you separate self-interest from interest in values, and often self-interest is cloaked in the language of values. But, you know, the British have certainly always, I think, felt that they have a special relationship with the United States because they share democratic values. And I think that has been important in NATO, I think. You know, the NATO has built itself around nations that are democratic and have a particular view of the world. But no, I think, you know, it's neither one thing nor the other. I think people enter into alliances, they think they'll get something out of it, but they may also have goals for a better sort of world, which they believe their allies might share.
But I don't want to anticipate what you're going to say in your next lecture, but what might one not say that one of the reasons Britain and France were a bit closer after 1917 was they both suspected Woodrow Wilson and both disliked Woodrow Wilson. And here you have a member, Woodrow Wilson, who doesn't even call his allies allies. He calls them associates, associated with America's war against Germany, but not necessarily allied to the United States in the sense of having common objectives.
Well, the relationship with the United States is an interesting one. And yes, now Woodrow Wilson very clearly said the United States will be an associate power and not an ally. But in both Britain and France, even among the political elites, there were those who shared many of Wilson's ideas and shared his vision of a different way of managing the world. I mean, you know, even Clemenceau, the old cynic, said, he said, I like the League, but I don't believe in it. But there were those who both liked the League and believed in it. You know, Europeans had just come through a hellish war, and they'd known what it had cost, and they'd known what damage it had done to European society. And so I think there was actually a community of values. I mean, you know, the scenes when Woodrow Wilson arrived in Europe were extraordinary. And I think he, you know, a lot of people really hoped that he was bringing the promise of a better world. Of course, many of his ideas came from Europe. These were ideas that Europeans themselves had been talking about before the First World War. And so I don't think it was just transactional. But yes, of course, British and French leaders did not want the United States to become too powerful in the affairs of Europe. And again, I think, you know, given human affairs, our motives are often mixed.
I'm going to open up to the Q&A in just one second, but can I ask one last question? Can one be very cynical and just say that the successful alliances are those in which countries choose the right enemies and the right partners? And if you choose the wrong enemies and the wrong partners, which was the story of Germany in the 20th century, your alliances are usually going to be very unhelpful to you. You know, the old canard that who was it who said that having Austria-Hungary as an ally was being like being shackled to a corpse? What could Austria-Hungary do for Germany? What could Italy, as a central power, had it gone into the war on Germany's side, have done for Italy? Surely the best ally that Germany ever had in the Second World War was the Soviet Union, very briefly, after the Nazi-Soviet Pact, because Stalin did a lot for Germany in terms of resources, et cetera, et cetera. But having Imperial Japan as an ally was useless to Germany, and of course Mussolini's Italy was an embarrassment. So could one say that the British have been lucky and the Americans have been lucky because they've always chosen the right enemies and they've always chosen the right partners?
That is cynical, isn't it?
Yes,
I'm just
or
thinking about
skeptical,
it.
perhaps.
Yes, skeptical. Let me think about it because I hadn't thought of it in those terms. But I think, well, of course, choosing the right allies matters, but it's then how you treat the allies. As you say, Hitler actually chose a good ally in Stalin, and it seems to me quite clear that Stalin had no intention, in spite of a recent book that argues this, Stalin had no intention of attacking Hitler. That he was hoping to build up Russia's strength, the Soviet Union's strength, and believed that he could manage Hitler, and that the relationship would last. So no, I think if Hitler had been prepared to stick with Stalin, it might have been a very different story. But given his own hatred of Bolshevism, and given his racial theories, given his longing to expand, there was no way that the relationship with the Soviet Union was going to last, at least in Hitler's eyes. But yes, choosing your allies makes sense, but sometimes people are thrown together by a shared threat. I mean, the British and the French were the least likely allies, given their history, and given the fact, that, I mean, a lot of people in Britain thought up until 1914 that the obvious ally for Britain was Germany. Germany was, they were each other's biggest trading partners. Germany was the economic powerhouse of the continent of Europe. Britain was the economic powerhouse of the world, although its position was beginning to be challenged. And Britain had the world's biggest navy. Germany had Europe's best army. I mean, there were a lot of people who said this is a match made in heaven. And there was actually far more, I think, of the British elites knew and appreciated Germany and German culture than they did French and French culture. I think at the time of when Britain went into the war in 1914, I think four members of the cabinet, the Asquith cabinet, had gone to German universities. The choice of allies, yes, I think is important, but sometimes you don't have a choice because someone decides to make war on you. I mean, I think if Germany had behaved differently before the First World War, the British would never have drawn closer to the French. I think it really was Germany pushing them into it.
Fine, thank you. Can we just now open it up? First question is there a distinction that you can make between voluntary alliances, such as NATO, and involuntary alliances, such as the Warsaw Pact, which you have just mentioned a moment ago? And is it a coincidence that members of the second, i.e., the Warsaw Pact, were so happy to join the first, i.e.,
Yeah.
NATO?
No, I think I think there's a huge distinction. I mean, rather like the alliance on the raft that was made on the raft at Tilsit. I mean, that was well, if not exactly involuntary, it was doomed not to last because the interests of the three countries there could not be reconciled. Napoleon wanted dominance, the others two wanted their independence. And so yes, involuntary alliances only last as long as someone can actually keep control of them. And I think, there was no talk of main, well, there was a tiny bit of talk at the end of the Cold War of turning the Warsaw Pact into something rather different. I mean, there was an interesting prospect that the Warsaw Pact could have been turned into some sort of security sharing arrangement for the center of Europe with Russia and the successor states. But it was never seriously taken. And I think the resentments that had built up over the years in what was effectively a Soviet empire in Eastern Europe made it impossible for any sort of, that sort of relationship to continue. I mean, in retrospect, it might have been a good idea to get some sort of security arrangement for the center of Europe, which spanned East and West and didn't divide it. But no, the Warsaw Pact was imposed. The members of it had no choice in what they did. They had no choice on whether Russian or Soviet troops were stationed on their soil or not. They had no choice over whether the pact went to war or not. NATO, I think, has survived because it was a voluntary alliance. People went into it for, of course, a variety of different reasons. And the states that emerged from the Warsaw Pact wanted to join it because they felt it was going to be safer for them. But no, I think there's a huge difference. It's like a forced marriage, I suppose, if you can use an analogy. A marriage that is freely chosen is more likely to last than when the two people are presented with a shotgun and told to marry each other.
Well, here's a question about Henry Kissinger's book, A World Restored, and what you have to say about his interpretation of Metternich and the Congress system that survived. When did the Congress system come to an end? 1818 or 1821, was it?
Well, I would say the Congress system, the Concert of Europe, in fact, lasted in a sort of form up until the Balkan Wars of 1912 and 1913. I mean, there was still this hope that you would get a conference of ambassadors who would come together and sort things out and prevent small local wars or small local insurrections or small local revolutions from spreading. And so the notion that the powers could actually work together, it seems to me, really doesn't disappear until 1914. And in a way, I think it's still with us today. You know, there's still this sense that Europe's powers, France, Britain, Germany, in particular, if they can work together, can actually help to make a stable and prosperous Europe. But I think the Crimean War really broke apart. I mean, there were crises before that, but it was the Crimean War that broke apart by putting the Russians on one side and the French and the British on another, that broke apart what had been a sort of working arrangements. I mean, I think the great strength of the Concert of Europe was that it wasn't formalized. You know, it was a series of meetings and it was a general attitude. I think that I very much take Paul Schroeder's argument that there'd been a really important shift in thinking. In the 18th century, statesmen and others tended to see international relations as a zero-sum game. If I win something, you have to lose. There's no combined benefit. And what the Napoleonic Wars, the wars first of the French Revolution and then the Napoleonic Wars did, is make people realize that in fact, if they cooperated, at least at some level, they could all benefit, that it was not just a zero-sum game, that there was actually a benefit in stability. I think, you know, I think the impact on, there's a new biography of Metternich, which I've been very struck by, and he argues the impact on Metternich, who lived through the French Revolution, who saw it firsthand, who saw what it had done to Europe, who frequently was fleeing into exile, whose family, of course, was very privileged, but nevertheless felt the effects of the revolution, recognized that stability was actually a virtue in itself. And that's something, of course, that Henry Kissinger has always argued for. You know, and it's a conservative view, but it is one which with which I have a certain sympathy, because without stability, you can't have much of anything else.
Well, I forget his first name, the historian Blanning, who writes a biography of Frederick the Great.
Tim Blanning.
Has this very nice phrase that as far as Frederick the Great's Europe was concerned, they saw Europe as a piranha tank, essentially, you know, the zero sum. Yeah. Everyone was attacking everyone else. And in the 19th century, you do have this kind of ideational idea of stability and civilization and the need to maintain order, which is so central. But Henry Kissinger brings me to the question I wanted to ask, if I can just now interpose again. The thing that keeps him up awake at night is the prospect of an alliance between China and Russia. And we're always assured by both the Chinese and Russians that an alliance is a long way off. An alignment is a different matter. Mm-hmm. But can I just ask you the question here that Xi Jinping often says that what makes the Chinese different from the West is that we don't do alliances, we have partnerships, we don't do coalition warfare, we haven't done it in our history with perhaps the exception of the Second World War. And now he's talking about the need to find friends. Do you draw this distinction between a diplomatic world of partnerships, by which he means, I think, trading partnerships or here today, gone tomorrow, alignments, and a world of alliances which fix you? And surely this was the argument in about 1914, that fix you in these very fixed positions and make it very difficult for you to be flexible in moments of great crisis.
Well, I'm not sure they do make it difficult to be flexible. I mean, the thing about an alliance, if you're looking at the narrow definition, which is a treaty has been signed, how do you enforce it? You know, there's usually an escape hatch. I mean, the Italians decided that under the terms of the treaty they had signed, they didn't have to get into the First World War. Now, the Germans and Austro-Hungarians thought this was awful and they said the Italians were criminal, but what could they do? You know, there's no court you can go to and say this person's broken the alliance and I want you to force them to adhere to it. I mean, it's not like what happens in domestic societies. So, you know, and I think the fact that the British took their time in deciding whether or not to get into the First World War show that they certainly felt that they didn't have a firm obligation. They had promises and they had indications, and the French ambassador in London said, you will no longer be an honorable nation if you don't join the war. But you know, how you define honor is very much a matter of the nation. I think the Chinese use of history is very selective. If you go back before China was united in 221 BC, Chinese history is full of people who made alliances. Sun Tzu, the great strategic thinker who is regarded as one of the founders of thinking about strategy, talks a lot about alliances. And the Chinese certainly have relationships with other powers, which I would call as being close to alliances. I mean, I think the difficulty the Chinese are finding is that in their foreign policy, they are not very good at the give and take, which makes a good alliance. They tend to want to dominate it. And the fact that they've managed to alienate most of their neighbors seems to me to say something about the lack of diplomacy with which they've been trying to build these relationships. I mean, I suppose it's possible, just to go back to the prospect of an alliance or relationship between China and Russia, it would be, I think, very much an ad hoc and short-term one, out of which both might think they get something. But if you look at the longer term, you know, the Russians share a very long border with China. They've got a real demographic problem, and they've got a real problem in the Far East, because there are far fewer Russians out in the Far East than there are Chinese. And I think this is a problem for them. They've got an economy which is not a fraction of what the Chinese economy is, and they've got serious problems at home. I mean, I think for the Russians to move too closely into a friendship with China would leave, it would be very much one dominated by China. And I think, you know, there is a long history between those two countries, which is not necessarily a happy one.
Well, this brings me to the next question about the cultural dimensions in building an alliance. And here's the exam question. Is the US capable of being a horse and not a rider in the alliance? And here I think the questioner is saying, the future alliances, the United States says, are with Asian societies, very different from the Western societies of the 20th century. Is the US capable of having a different set of relations with a different set of Asian countries, the Quad, for example, or others? Because as you were saying, if you all happen to come from the same culture in the 20th century and you're having Western alliance systems, then perhaps culturally those are going to be stronger, because whatever the political tensions, you know, between Clemenceau and Woodrow Wilson might be, they're still on the same team. Do you see this as being a problem for the US?
Possibly two things. I mean, I think nothing lasts forever in history. And I think the United States rose very rapidly to a position of world dominance. And the indication, certainly from the recent polls, is that a lot of Americans don't really care about that anymore. They're more focused on issues at home, problems at home. A recent poll, I think it was a Pew poll, said to Americans, you know, do you worry that the United States might no longer be number one in the world? And something like 57% said, no, we don't. And we don't really care about our position in the world. And so, you know, I do think countries, societies change, maybe slowly, maybe rapidly. But the United States has not always been the dominant power in the world. And, you know, there will be a future in which it perhaps isn't. But as far as culture goes, I mean, what is American culture? I mean, the United States has a huge immigrant population that comes from Asia, as does my own country, Canada. And I think you could argue that the culture of the United States is changing. I mean, it's moving away, although there are those who resist it, but I think it's moving away from a sort of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant European sort of culture, which has so much influenced culture in the United States. And if you go to the West Coast of the United States in particular, but all over the United States, you know, there are very strong links now with Asian countries, people from Asian countries. And I think this will probably affect the perception the Americans have of themselves, the nature of their culture, and their relationships with Asia. And of course, you also have the tremendous export of American cultural artifacts, American cultural influences. A number of Asian countries have been very much influenced by the United States. And so I think what we may be seeing is not a division between cultures, but a mingling of cultures. You know, I've never really bought that Samuel Huntington thesis about the clash of civilizations. I think civilizations are always changing and cultures are always changing. And they change over time, and they change as a result of patterns of immigration. They change as a result of cultural influences flowing in and flowing out. But, you know, the United States, I think, has always been a Pacific power. But I think in some ways, its cultural ties with Asia are perhaps stronger than they've ever been, and likely to deepen.
Perhaps I can just ask you to develop that a little bit more, because 25 years ago, I went to a conference in Israel, which was entitled, Does the United States Have Allies? And it was quite clear from our hosts that, yes, it only has one ally, and that was clearly Israel. It's a very strange alliance between the United States and Israel from a European perspective. But the first day was the Europeans, and they were all saying, what must we do to keep the United States on side, interested in Europe and standing up against Russia? Yeah. And the Asian countries, and that included the Australians, were saying, what must America do so that we are interested in remaining allies of the United States. That seemed to me to be a very interesting cultural difference between the two. So it's a very crude, putting it very crudely, but it is interesting. And I think culture is interesting. And, you know, only the Brits will talk about a special relationship because it's part of the special history of the United States and the UK. It's very difficult to imagine the Japanese talking about a special relationship with the United States or India or any of the future allies of the United States that where America would like to be future allies of the United States.
I've always thought the special relationship is, and this is unkind perhaps, but grew out of a slight sense of desperation. And we know there are cultural connections, but I mean, you have to remember the United States also was born in an act of revolt against the British Empire. But I think Churchill was very aware in the Second World War of Britain's declining power in relation to the United States and the Soviet Union. I mean, Britain, as I say, still remained a very powerful country with an enormous economic base, but also still had large parts of the empire. But it was clearly not as powerful by 1945 as it had been, and the United States was much more powerful. And I think there was this hope, which I think is still there, that the British could somehow balance. They could be the balance between the continent of Europe and the United States because they spoke English, because they shared apparently cultural values, and Churchill always made a great thing of his American mother, that the British could somehow talk to the Americans. In Harold Macmillan's famous phrase, we could be the Athenians to the Romans. We can sort of be their interlocutors because we understand them, and then we can interpret them to the Europeans, which will make us important. I've always thought the special relationship has been far more important to the British than the Americans. And I think it's become less so to the Americans. I think a lot of the Americans don't know they're meant to have a special relationship with Britain. And I think the passage of time, I mean, there was in 1945 and post-war years, there was a whole cohort of Americans who had perhaps been educated in Britain, who knew Britain. They came from the East Coast. Some of them had been in Britain during the war, in the State Department. There were people who really understood Britain. That cohort's vanished. And the younger generation, I think, understands and cares less about Britain. I think it was very striking. I don't know if you've read Barack Obama's, not his latest memoir, but the one about my father. And he came to England as a student and had absolutely no sympathy for it at all, disliked it. I think never had any feeling for Britain. And I think, you know, the United States is shifting away. It's partly passage of time, the passage of generations, but it's also shifting because of its immigration patterns. And I think far more Americans feel ties to either Latin America or to Asia.
Here's another question, since we've been talking about alliances and war very largely, and you've been talking about an era of boots on the ground, as the questioner says. Well, what about tomorrow's wars? Cyber wars, hybrid wars, proxy wars, you mention it, very different kind of warfare. How important will alliances, do you think, be in these circumstances?
I would have thought very important, because when you think of cyber war, for example, there is no way that a single country, with the possible exception of China, can manage its own internet and manage all these links that link it to the rest of the world. It seems to me that the only way to deal with cyber war and to deal with the sort of attacks that have come, the bot attacks, for example, is international cooperation. That it's beyond the resources of any country to do it on its own. As I say, China is a possible exception, but the penalty that China's paying for that is to close China off and close the Chinese off to exposure to ideas and attitudes, which is, of course, perhaps what they want to do, but may in the long run hurt China. But I think, given the nature of the weapons that are now developing, I think there's going to have to be cooperation. I mean, this is what I suppose in part, this new UK-Australia US deal is about, that it's in some of this, the types of warfare that are developing can only be done in coalition, cannot be done by a single country.
Mm-hmm. And here's a very significant question. You've been talking about alliances against states that are seen rightly or wrongly to be threats. The two great challenges, the two great threats, if you want to use that word, this century are likely to be global pandemics and climate change. Yeah. And how important are alliances likely to be. I noticed that after COP26, we seem to have two blocks forming. We've got the 2050 Club, which is the old alliance of Japan, the West, the European Union, the United States, zero emissions by 2050. And now we've got also China, Russia, and Saudi Arabia, zero emissions in 2060. So you do see already two blocks forming on the climate change. But I mean, the main thing is, can you have alliances against non-state threats? You might want to throw in terrorism here as well as being a non-state threat.
Oh, I think you can. I mean, you know, yes, if you accept my definition of alliances as being something broader than a promise to come to each other's defense if attacked, yes, I think you definitely can. And in fact, I think you have to have, you know, that what brings about a coalition, what brings about the formation of an alliance is a threat that is seen as so great that a single member of the alliance can't deal with it on its own. And pandemic is a classic, you know, a very good example of that, because viruses do not respect borders. I mean, you know, the what is it now? The Omicron is not going to stop at the South African border and say, oh, I better not go over the border because I don't have my right papers with me. I mean, you know, this is given the interconnectedness of the world, pandemics are inevitable. We're going to have other ones. And it is, I think, virtually impossible to stop them traveling around the world. Virtually impossible, as we've seen. And the only way in which we're going to bring the pandemic under control is, in fact, to build alliances. And one of the real failures, I think, of some of the developed powers is to actually do more effectively for the poorer parts of the world, to make vaccines available to help in the vaccination effort. And until they realize, I think the developed powers have to realize that, you know, it's not just altruism. It's in their own interest to do it. And I think the same thing with climate change. I mean, there may be different groupings on how to deal with it. But again, we've all had it if this planet becomes uninhabitable. And so you can build whatever grouping you want. But if the future of humanity on the planet is in question, it doesn't really matter who's on which side, because sides aren't going to matter in that circumstance. And I do think, I mean, I think we see this realization, because often when you face a major, societies face major crises like this, they use the language of war. They often talk about a campaign, or they talk about mobilizing resources. They talk about waging war. Terrorism, internet, you know, terrorism is another, I think, example of where alliances make sense. I mean, I've always thought the war on terror is an absurd idea. You can't have a war on a concept. And the danger of the war on terror is it's not clear what the enemy is and when the enemy's been defeated. It seems to me a very unfortunate analogy. But the most effective means, I think, of dealing with terrorism have been good police work and shared intelligence, and cooperating in that way, and sharing information. I mean, I think this has been extremely important. But yes, I think you can have alliances to carry out things which represent a threat. I mean, there was a sort of alliance that developed in 2008 to deal with a financial crisis. You know, the United States, Britain, a number of countries, Canada, et cetera, France, Germany came together, you know, suddenly and quickly, because they recognized that if they didn't, things might get even worse.
Now, would you see the G7 and the G20 as alliances of a certain kind, or just a groupings or alignments?
I'd see them more as grouping and alignments. I mean, there is a sort of blurry line, I think, a blurred line between an alliance and a grouping. But an alliance, it seems to me, does actually have a purpose and perhaps a strategy for achieving what it wants. And my own feeling about the G7 and the G20 is that they've become more and more just talking shops, and I'm not sure they serve much purpose anymore. I mean, I think they did when they were first organized, but I think increasingly they've just become photo opportunities. I'm rather cynical about them, actually.
And what would you say about Rumsfeld's idea that you shouldn't have alliances? You need coalitions of the willing. In other words, quick fit things, do it yourself. You know, you put them together for a specific purpose. The mission determines the alliance, not the alliance determines the mission. I think this is one of his famous statements.
Yeah, or someone said cynically, the coalitions of the billing.
Coalitions of the billing, indeed.
Yeah, but you know, the trouble with that is you throw people together. If they've had no experience of working together, they're not going to be that effective. Mm. You know, one of the things that the British and French had to learn very painfully in the First World War is that they needed to actually share technology, they needed to share tactics, they needed to learn to work together. And there's an element of trust. I mean, I heard, and I may be wrong, but I heard that in the sort of collapse in Afghanistan, when the Western powers were scrambling to get out, there was actually very bad feeling between the Americans and some of the other partners there, that the Americans were not consulting with anyone else. Now, this may or may not be true, but I've heard it from a number of sources. And if you don't work with each other in a crisis, you're not going to be very good at doing it. You know, if you haven't learned each other's ways and ways of doing things and developed a respect for each other and understand, you know, how you work with each other, then you're not going to be, you can throw people together, but they're not going to be, you know, all that effective, I think.
Well, Margaret, we've only got about 3.5 minutes left. And I just want to, because you've used the word trust so many times, what's the relationship, do you think, today between France and Britain? It's a very, very unhappy moment in the history of both of them when it comes to trust. Yeah. Seems trust is the key issue.
Yeah, well, it really does. And, it, you know, the thing is, it takes a long time to build up trust, and you can undermine it very quickly. I've been longing for a chance to say donnez-moi and break. But, you know, it just seems to me that the British are... And the French are not blameless in this, but the British perhaps are unnecessarily antagonizing the French when they're going to have to work with them. I mean, you know, when your nearest neighbor, a country you trade with, a company you're in a defense relationship with, a country which you hope will help you to deal with immigration issues, it seems to me weak and self-defeating, I think, to alienate them unnecessarily. And I do think this period, I may be wrong, and I hope I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the sort of rancor and the accusations flying back and forth do not bode well for the future relationship between Britain and France.
No. Well, that's a rather sobering note on which perhaps to conclude. I'd like to, before I thank you formally, I'd just like to flag up to everyone that the second lecture in this series is going to be on the 24th of January at 18:30, and it will be about victory and the making of peace. The Allies in the First World War. And I do encourage you to tune in for that. But thank you very much, Margaret, for an absolutely wonderful lecture. We're going to come back to some of these themes, I think, over the next few lectures as well. And thank you for being here with us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.